Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast going to the top of the class. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
We're going to talk about schools. We're going to talk about educational inequality. We're going to talk about what the government's treatment of education tells us about their administration. We're not going to be pretty. The government planned that all primary schools would open for the final few weeks of the school year in about late June, early July. Those plans have now been dropped. Was there anything maybe that the government could have done to try and avert that situation from happening?
Almost certainly, yes, there probably was a number of things they could have done. But essentially, rather than actually look to try and solve the logistical problems that existed within like the context of teaching in a physical school environment whilst coronavirus is an issue, rather than actually look to try and solve those problems, they decided they were just going to try and pick a fight with the trade unions. It probably actually is possible that we could find a means to operate schools that allow for social distancing in some capacity, where teachers are in there, everybody is relatively safe. The only issue is that requires a lot of effort and it requires a lot of skill and project management. Let's take one particular item just off the top of my head. A lot of schools don't necessarily have enough rooms to house all the kids in a socially distanced way. So we've immediately got a kind of like a problem of physical space. Okay, well, in the past, certainly like temporary classrooms have been utilized in some instances quite permanently for some schools. If the government was serious about looking to do that, they'd be looking to invest in those temporary classrooms. If there's an issue in terms of schools not having enough teachers available, you can bring in substitutes. You can bring in people. You can hire people to do it. You can provide some incentivization for teachers to get back in there if you felt it was needed. Although in reality, based on the teachers I've spoken to, their concern was more not oh no, we don't want to do the work. It's just like we want to make sure everybody's safe. So really, if you'd made sure everything was as safe as it could be, you know, most of them would happily turn up again, I think. So immediately you've got a couple of issues there with some couple of solutions which might be available, but the government doesn't really look to have talked about them, doesn't look like they've done anything on those sort of areas, largely, I feel, because the education secretary is somebody who does not give a crap. That is Gavin Williamson, the assassin-faced baby. I think Stephen Bush put it quite nicely in one of his pieces, where he said that Williamson is viewing his time as education secretary as a stepping stone to a bigger role, and his interest is not in actively helping resolve any of the situations but in scoring brownie points with the Conservative Party leadership and the Conservative Party base, because this is a man who clearly wants to be prime minister at some point, and I bet money on it now that whenever the next Tory leadership is, he's one of the candidates.
I've literally just had a shiver run through my spine.
It's like absolute nightmare scenario, and you have to choose which one of these people is prime minister, Corey. Michael Gove or Gavin Williamson, who do you pick?
I think we should move on. I can't.
A lot of these problems are surmountable, but they require significant financial investment, and they require some planning, and they require somebody who actually cares about trying to resolve the issue and not score brownie points. None of those things are available with Gavin Williamson. You also have a kind of, I feel like this is one which it's, to a degree, you might say it's a bit unfair to the government, but I do feel like from the get-go, they should have been doing more to help encourage virtual learning in some capacity. from everything I've seen and heard, it doesn't look like the government has kind of worked with schools particularly well to offer that much assistance in terms of here's the best practice for how you can set up virtual learning for your kids and for your students, which in return means you end up with a very mixed bag where some places, just by virtue of leadership that's in place, I would imagine, have got decent systems in place, not ideal still, but things that can kind of keep learning ticking over. But then you've got other ones who just don't have that ability at all. And as a result, you end up with very different outcomes to amongst schools, as, you know, they just end up adopting different ways of doing things, or if the government is getting involved, it's not necessarily giving them meaningful advice. It's just, here, use Google Classroom, which is great. That's the software system. That's not a best practice. That's something that should have been more of a focus from the get-go. Whether or not it's a fair critique of the government to basically say, yes, you must revolutionize virtual and e-learning in the middle of everything else, this is probably a bit debatable, but I do feel like that's something they should have been doing more on, from what I can see at least.
Let's pick up on a few of the things there then. So, Gavin Williamson, I mean, who could have predicted, Steve, that someone who is Defence Secretary was best known for A, telling Russia to shut up and go away, and B, leaking from a confidential National Security Council meeting would be maybe not the best person to try and provide reassurance to our teachers and young folk that he knew how to run an education system.
And no one could have foreseen this, absolutely no one. It's truly a shocking outcome.
He's talked a lot about the need to support teachers and pupils from disadvantaged backgrounds, but then not much has actually happened as a result. So as you say, we've seen a lot of union bashing, a lot of it from anonymous sources in the government, a lot of it then reflected in our tabloid press. There's been a couple of Daily Mail headlines, one of which I think at the height of the farrago between schools and unions was, let our teachers be heroes, almost as though teachers weren't being heroes at the moment, having certainly the school that I worked at before I left for my new position, essentially two senior members of staff worked over a weekend when it looked like schools might be, this is the weekend before schools were shut, and essentially set up accounts for all the staff, all the pupils, to enable that online learning to take place.
Yeah.
Weren't given any guidance for DfE. They did it because teachers work above and beyond to make sure that their pupils can be educated. Teachers are still working and educating pupils. That just seems to be lost. I think what's happening is you've got the malign hand of Dominic Cummings behind it, haven't you? Because he was a spad for Michael Gove. And Gove and Cummings, when Gove was at the DfE, talked about the blob and sort of borrowed this term that I think originates on the American right, doesn't it? I think it's what they now they call it the deep state because it sounds very sort of 24, like paranoid criminal conspiracy theories. But back then, the blob is almost this kind of amorphous, like civil servants, teachers, unions, you know, general lefty bastards who don't want anything to change and want to stand in the way of good progress and all this kind of nonsense. And certainly one of the things that I think the government was trying to do at the start of the year was pick fights with the blob as they saw it. I mean, we saw that with their treatment of senior Home Office officials, for instance. And so I think they saw this crisis as a good opportunity to bash teaching unions. If you were a government that was serious about getting kids back to school, you would do what they did in Denmark. And in Denmark, what they did was they published the scientific guidance about when it was safe to let kids back into school. And that guidance was used as the basis of detailed discussions with the unions to enable a timetable to enable kids to go back to school. And that quite simply hasn't happened here because the government's far too busy trying to play politics with the unions and find some decent headlines rather than actually govern effectively.
But there's been a massive issue, I feel, with this government in general, certainly with coronavirus, and I think broadly as well, around transparency. They don't like to give out information that they're using to make decisions. They don't like to make it clear what the rationale behind decisions is, largely because I suspect it will make them look bad, and they know it will make them look bad. That lack of transparency means that they can't actively make any progress, because as you say, the best way to get kids back in school is to actually have meaningful discussions with the people who are going to be involved with it, so that everybody can actually feel comfortable and feel safe and secure, so you can get everybody on board. That's not to say every single teacher will be happy about it, but the unions kind of sign off on it. Very few people are going to have a leg to stand on if they do want to complain about it. But rather than do that, they decided they were going to hoard their information and just go on the attack. Because it's easy to attack, it's very difficult to plan and actually make a difference.
Well, and it goes back to the issue of this government that we've talked about a few times, which is they're a government that sets about campaigning, not about governing things.
Yeah.
Throughout the coronavirus crisis, they've been about trying to manage the headlines rather than, say, get PPE to frontline workers. or just simply tell head teachers and local leaders and councillors what's actually happening. Because head teachers are getting the plans from the government at the same time that we are, Steve, and that's at the government's 5 o'clock press conference. And that happened just, for instance, this week or last week. But so recently, Boris Johnson gave his weekly press conference and talked about a massive catch-up operation over the summer for pupils who'd missed out on school that Gavin Williamson was going to announce. And what seems to have happened there, which Johnson's done a few times, is shoot his mouth off, offering something that's generically optimistic when there isn't actually any planned announcement behind it. That leaves head teachers in even more uncertainty, because it leaves 3 or 4 days in which head teachers have no idea what's going on. And it just leads to more uncertainty when actually all he had to do was, to quote Gavin Williamson, shut up and go away, wait until there were plans in place for some sort of catch-up operation, and then announce them. And the other thing is, like, what would the practicalities of that catch-up operation be? Because if you're assuming there's going to be some sort of operation in which you get some sort of dad's army of former teachers like myself to go in, like Captain Mannering style, former Home Guard, and educate the nation's young, you've got a bit of an issue with, if you've got retired teachers who are going to be older and shielding, that might also be a bit of an issue in terms of transmission of the virus. But I mean, the other issue is, are parents really going to want to send their kids with lots of random other kids, maybe from the same school or other schools, into a room where, again, lots of different random teachers are coming in? I mean, I think parents could well have concerns over the safety of that as well, let alone how exactly are you going to teach these kids and what are you going to teach them and how are you going to do it over the summer?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this kind of goes back to that, to the point I was making earlier about kind of like maybe like virtual learning and e-learning and things like that. Because if you are saying, okay, we need to put some stuff in place over the summer to try and help get these kids back to where they should have been by the end of this academic year, which is a good thing to try and do, absolutely. But again, you've got the, okay, what's the logistics of this? What's the actual plan to deliver on this? And Johnson's, I feel like this is just a point that I keep on making, but it just keeps on coming up time and time again. Johnson's desire to be liked, Johnson's desire to just to make sure that everybody feels good after he's made a statement means that he makes an announcement which doesn't have any kind of actual thought behind it, as you've already said. But again, if they had been thinking this through properly from the beginning, and they'd been looking at, say, virtual learning as a thing from the get-go, seriously, they might have now been in a position where they could have said, okay, yes, we are aware that we need to do some makeup classes over the summer. This is roughly what it's going to look like. We don't want to kind of open up the schools again, but we do have this kind of setup for virtual learning, which will involve, even at this stage, just a vague notion of what it looks like. You don't even have necessarily to have the curriculum or whatever agreed on it, but just a sense of, here's a rough structure for what it would look like. But instead, we've just got waffle and more panic as Gavin Williamson desperately goes around to try and find a way to make it work, which I bet will just boil down to, yeah, all of these kids need to go into school now, but we can't send them into school because we don't have the social distancing yet. Yeah, but they have to now. It's like,
before we even talk about the practicalities of social distancing in school, let's just quickly talk about the practicalities of making sure every child has the opportunity to work at home. And it's one of the things that really has frustrated me about this education debate that we'll doubtless talk about in a second. And that's that people are rightly, genuinely, I'm sure, and rightly concerned that the most disadvantaged kids are missing out. And one of the reasons why people are quite keen for kids to return is because the most disadvantaged pupils are being hit hardest by this. However, the same people who are now, especially on the conservative side, who are saying that they don't want the disadvantaged pupils to miss out, are exactly the same people who over the past 10 years have not only cut programs which benefit the most disadvantaged, but also have pushed through educational reforms which have increased inequality in the education system. And one sort of example of that, I suppose, is this issue of access to technology.
Yeah.
So, and that's a particular issue in the school I used to work at, where there's a very, very genuine issue of two or three or four children in a household who don't all have access to a laptop at the same time. And nationwide, there are apparently 700,000 children who don't have access to a laptop or any computer that could sort of help their educational learning. Now, the Department for Education has a scheme which is meant to be sending out 230,000 laptops to pupils who need them. Now, you will have noticed that, therefore, that means you're going to have 470,000 pupils who aren't going to get access to these laptops at all. Even if there was some sort of online learning, they can't access it. That's, you know, nearly 500,000 children. But only 100,000 laptops have been sent out from the Department of Education. The schools were closed towards the end of March.
Yeah.
So we've had 3 months now. The Department for Education still hasn't got its head round even providing laptops to even half of the target that they wanted to send them out to, of these disadvantaged children, of these children who don't have laptops. And even that figure was only about a third of the number who needs them anyway.
I honestly, I don't know what more can be said. Like, it just the facts speak for themselves in terms of how badly this entire debate has been handled by the government. It's almost at the point where you've got to laugh, otherwise you're going to cry, because this is an incredibly serious situation which will affect the livelihoods of thousands and thousands of kids.
Shall we talk a bit about the practicalities then of opening? Because as you've said, like, the problem is that at the moment the social distancing is 2 meters. You need to spend 2 meters apart. There's talk now in the Tory party of trying to loosen that, which I don't know. And again, this is one of the things, but I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't want to comment on the science. I genuinely am not sure whether the science now says it's 1 meter, because now a lot of countries are saying it's just 1 meter, not two, or how much it is a lot of people in the Tory party are trying to keep it 2 meters to try and open the economy up and get some growth going.
So the WHO advice, I believe, is that you can drop it down. So you can drop social distancing down to a meter, but there is an increase in risk of increased infection. So it's one of those things where at a certain point in the kind of like the pandemic spread within your country, there is probably actually a point where it becomes a reasonable risk. To kind of drop it down to a meter so that, you know, things can start to get back to normal. That's not to say that 2 meters is wrong and incorrect. It's just that there is a potential that for a 1 meter, but it comes with an increased risk of transmission.
And again, just if you can have social distancing in a classroom doesn't mean that it's still going to be an absolute nightmare for social distancing generally. I mean, there's issues of, are you going to clean play equipment after every break time and lunchtime, say? I mean, there's a wonderful, I say wonderful, again, it's that if you laugh or cry. So the government's plan was to try and get year one pupils back first. And again, you've got this odd disparity there that if you had a 4-year-old child and an 8-year-old child, that 4-year-old child might be getting 20 or 30 hours of schooling a week, but then your 8-year-old child is getting no hours of schooling, rather than if you've only got limited resources, maybe just try and get both children in for 10 or 15 hours a week. But I digress. Steve, I'm sure you would know that it's very easy for 4 and 5 year olds to maintain social distancing at all times. It's just something that's ingrained into the minds of young children.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When I went for a walk around the park down by me the other day and was wandering up past the kind of like the play area and the skate park that's there, there was all kinds of children who were running around playing with each other and were absolutely not maintaining social distancing at all.
A couple of sentences in the guidelines. This is from about a month ago. I wrote a blog for Liam Burns' site on this. But so the guidance as it was then said, we know that unlike older children and adults, early years and primary age children cannot be expected to remain 2 meters apart from each other and staff. In deciding to bring more children back to early years and schools, we are taking this into account, which is comically contradictory.
Yeah. We're taking this into account. How? Like, what does that mean?
I think basically what the guidance goes on to say then is that teachers should encourage pupils to wash hands more and minimise contact, and then everything will be fine.
Okay.
But so let's think about it. Let's think about it in a practically. So I've got this from John Coles, who wrote this in a Twitter thread that Laura McKinnery, who's a very good former teacher, now founded Teacher Tap, which is an excellent resource for teachers. So the 24,000 schools in the UK, there are 8.77 million children. I'll test you on these figures later. Now, the biggest issue is literally anyone, you don't even have to have worked ever in the school to realise this. The biggest issue is social distancing at the moment is classes of 15 pupils is needed so there's a proper space. Except usually you've got 30 kids in a class. I think the average number is 27, which therefore means, well, at the moment, there are 585,000 spaces in schools, in classrooms, apparently. And you would therefore need 250,000 more spaces. And that is a lot of spaces. I mean, to put that into context, there are only 10,000 village halls in the whole country. So there's not many places that are going to be big enough to have temporary classrooms, even if you could have a temporary classroom, because obviously if it's a temporary classroom like a village hall, well, how does that work if you want a science lab or a DT suite or an art room? It's just impossible. Right. So you've got that particular problem. Now, has the government actually looked into the practicalities of finding more classrooms for people? Well, obviously not, because most schools were stretched just finding enough space so that they could teach their reception kids, year one kids, and this is primary schools anyway, at a social distance. You've then got the issue of teachers. If you're going to have smaller classrooms, you need more teachers. At the moment, there's 450,000 teachers in the UK. Even if you were to take that figure, which is debatable, because obviously some are clinically vulnerable and may well be shielding, but you would need 650,000 teachers if you were going to try and do this in a social distance way. Well, that's 200,000 teachers. How the chuff are you meant to try and recruit, train, equip 200,000 teachers?
You can't. Fundamentally, is the core issue there? It's just not possible. Like, I keep on harking back to this. These are the sorts of issues which they should have run the numbers on and gone, okay, this may not be physically possible to actually do this. So what are the alternatives? Well, the alternatives are e-learning and things like that. So where you could have the same number of teachers teaching, in theory, their same classes, just online. Yes, there's still going to be problems with that in terms of internet access, in terms of all kinds of little things. But you suddenly end up in a situation where you identify the problem and then you can go, okay, what's the solution, rather than running around like a headless chicken, which is what the government's doing.
Well, and I think it's at the moment, the narrative from the press is almost, well, the kids are at home, so they're not learning, which is also a little bit unfair, because obviously often pupils might learn by observing adults, which they're maybe doing with their parents at the home. And the other thing is that a lot of them are taking place in remote learning at schools. Mm-hmm. But I think it was the iNewspaper, there was this headline when the government announced this, that schools wouldn't be opening till September. We haven't even talked, by the way, about the fact that private schools like Eton, were never going to open till September anyway. This is just a discussion mainly about comprehensive schools in the UK, the headline, I believe it was in the iPaper, was "Take the rest of the year off," which is an incredibly misleading headline, not just about the teachers who are working at the moment, but also to any pupil or any parent. Again, you're working from home and you're learning at home, and there's learning that can take place at home. And it's not fair to say it's just about sitting on your bottom and playing Fortnite.
Going back to some of my clients, I at various points I've spoken to some of my clients about how they're getting on with the lockdown situation and social distancing, and they've said, well, yeah, it's been challenging trying to do my job whilst also actually educate my kid. Like a lot of parents are actively getting involved with their kids' learning because they know how important it is. And the kids are still learning things. Like there's multiple kind of levels of kind of like engagement happening. You've got the schools setting the work and actually trying to do the best they can to try and educate the kids as much as they can, given the constraints they've got. You've got the kids who are actually doing the learning. And then you've also got parents who are actively trying to get involved as well as best they can, because, you know, as I said, they know this is important, and a lot of them are doing this whilst also working full-time jobs still.
It's been a whole failure of policy all down the line, but I think it's, if we finish off with this, it's a failure of policy that's been happening for years.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting debate about sort of anecdote and structures, because there's been a lot of talk, as I say rightly, that the poorest pupils are going to lose out from education and are more likely to be negatively impacted by schools closing in a whole number of ways.
Yeah.
But I think what that loses out on is actually there's been a lot of government policies which have actually increased educational inequality and have massively disproportionately affected pupils from poorer backgrounds. Let's just take one example, which is, it's not just spending on schools which affects poorer pupils. You've got, youth services have been cut massively, affecting disproportionately people from poorer backgrounds. Even cuts affecting parks, for instance, or youth centres, all that sort of thing. But just most fundamentally, if we're going to talk about cuts on austerity that has increased child poverty over the past 10 years, and we've got, you know, record numbers using food banks. If we're going to just think that, basically, fundamentally, if you're hungry, you're not going to learn. So pupils being hungry is a massive, massive, massive issue. Now, the government is not committing at the moment to extending the free school meal scheme over the summer to its poorest pupils. And we also know the summer is often that school meal might be the most nutritious hot meal a pupil has in a day. If you're worried about pupils from disadvantaged backgrounds and the educational welfare and happiness that they've got, surely the key thing is to make sure that they are hungry and that they are fed. And the government isn't even committing to do that.
Yeah. Again, it's just a massive cascade of failures on every single line, which just, like, you know, I'm pretty sure, I know I've said this to you before, and I'm sure I've said it on the podcast as well. Like, I'm a great believer, generally speaking, in incompetence rather than conspiracy as to why screw-ups happen or why bad outcomes occur. But we're getting to the point where I feel like that belief is being tested, especially in regards to the education brief for this government, because I don't see how you have people as highly educated as they are, and this is the thing, these aren't dumb people, they are highly educated and have a degree of intelligence, how they get to this point and have just managed to screw everything up so badly.
I think it's ideological. I mean, a lesson of the recent history, I suppose, is that it's possible for intelligent people to do terrible things for well-intentioned ideological reasons. And that's, speaking of which, Michael Gove's education reforms, that in his reforms, he ignored any advice from teachers, from unions, from education academics, because he saw them as the blob. He saw them as not people who he should listen to, but actually and certainly I think Cummings probably fueled this view, that if he was earning their enmity, that was actually something that he sought and should be praised for rather than something to shy away from. And you can see it in things like the curriculum changes, which have led to a narrowing of the curriculum, you know, music not necessarily being taught in schools, focus on English and maths in particular. You've also got those coalition reforms have led to an increase in educational inequality, partly because that focus on league tables, that focus on testing, means that actually incentivizes schools to look after their own and not cooperate. So, for instance, the amount of pupils from poorer backgrounds which are taken in by higher performing secondary schools has fallen over the past 10 years. You've got lots of things which impact disproportionately on kids from poorer backgrounds. You've got that structural inequality. You've got the cuts, especially cuts to lower local authorities as well. And also just that shift from go changes the name from Department for Children, Schools and Families to Department for Education. And I think that change in itself is interesting because, again, it ignores the fact that actually it's not just about the education that pupils receive. It's about their wider welfare that is just ignored in all of this, really.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you care about social mobility and education and equality of opportunity, that really only happens with equality of outcome. And therefore, you need to also give a toss about child poverty. Right. Was this cathartic or was this depressing? Or was it both, maybe?
I don't know.
Okay. If you'd like to hear more of our content and episodes and support content like this going out, you could visit our Patreon page, couldn't you, Steve?
You can indeed. You can head over there, fling us a couple of quid every month and get access to unique content, which we put up for our champagners, as I think we're calling them at the moment. That may change in future. And you'll get access to some currently Zoom calls and chats and things that we're doing with various members of our kind of like recurring talking heads. You'll also get early access to certain bits and pieces that we produce as well. So yeah, it's all good fun. Head over, check it out, and hopefully we'll see you there.
And that's patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. Our other website is notenoughchampagne.com, and our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram, and Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm @PaperbackRioter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
Happy Sunday.